Around the group before the fire, all the faces were anxious. The white faces in the front row, the Negro faces, eyes white and large behind. A preliminary aerial survey of the country has been completed. By order of the acting chief executive, Mrs. Van Brucker Brown, certain areas have been declared contaminated zones. It is forbidden for people to enter these zones. It is forbidden to bring any material of any kind, particularly metal or metal containers, out of these zones. Persons leaving the contaminated zones must first be examined at checkpoints now being established. The location of these checkpoints will be announced over your local Conelrad stations. The contaminated zones are the New England states. Sam Hazard, sitting in a prim cherry wood rocker, which, like Sam, had originated in New England, drew in his breath. The newscaster continued. All of New York State, south of the line Ticonderoga, Sackett's Harbor. The state of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland. The District of Columbia. Ohio, east of the line Sandusky, Chillicothe. Also in Ohio, the city of Columbus and its suburbs. In Michigan, Detroit and Dearborn, and an area of 50-mile radius from these cities. Also in Michigan, the cities of Flint and Grand Rapids. In Virginia, the entire Potomac River Basin. The cities of Richmond and Norfolk and their suburbs. In South Carolina, the port of Charleston and all territory within a 30-mile radius of Charleston. In Georgia, the cities of Atlanta, Savannah, Augusta, and their suburbs. The state of Florida. Randy felt angry and insulted. He shifted his weight and started to get to his feet. Not the whole state, he said, at the same time realizing his protest was completely irrational. Shh, Lib said, and pulled him back to the rug. The voice went on, ticking off Mobile and Birmingham, New Orleans, and Lake Charles. It moved into Texas, obliterating Fort Worth and Dallas and everything within a 50-mile radius of these two cities, and Abilene, Houston, and Corpus Christi. It moved northward again. In Arkansas, Little Rock and its suburbs, plus an area of 40 miles to the west of Little Rock. Missouri, who through the whole evening had said nothing except in answer to questions, now said something. How come they hit Little Rock? The admiral said, there's a big sack base in Little Rock, or was. The voice moved up to Oak Ridge in Tennessee, and then spoke of Chicago and everything around Chicago in northern Indiana, and crept up the western shore of Lake Michigan to Milwaukee and Milwaukee's suburbs. Inexorably, it uttered the names of Kansas City, Wichita, and Topeka. The voice continued. In Nebraska, Lincoln. Also in Nebraska, Omaha, and all the territory within a 50-mile radius of Omaha. There goes all hope of Mark, Randy thought. More than one missile for Omaha. Probably three, as Mark had expected, from the moment of the double dawn on the day he had known it was probable. Now he must accept it as almost certain. He looked across the circle at three faces in the firelight. Peyton's face was half hidden against her mother's breast. Helen's face bent down, and her arms were around Peyton's shoulders. Ben Franklin stared into the fire, his chin straight. Randy could see the tear path down Helen's face and the unshed tears in Ben's eyes. The announcements went on, the voice calling out portions of states and cities, Seattle, Hanford, San Francisco, all the Southern California coast, Helena, Cheyenne, but Randy only half heard them. All he could hear distinctly were the sharp sobs out of Peyton's throat. Randy's heart went out to them, but he said nothing. What was there to say? How do you say to a little girl that you are sorry she no longer has a father? Close to his side, Lib stirred and spoke, two words only, to Helen. I'm sorry. Randy had noticed that evening a tenseness between Helen and Lib. Nothing was said, and yet there was a watchfulness, a hostility between them. So he was glad that Lib had spoken. He wanted them to like each other. He was puzzled that they didn't. Then it was over. The radio stilled. More than ever, Randy felt cut off and isolated. Florida was a prohibited zone, and Fort Repose a tiny, isolated sector within that zone. He could appreciate why the whole state had been designated a contaminated area. There were so many bases, so many targets which had been hit with resulting contamination. They had been extraordinarily fortunate in Fort Repose. The wind had favored them. They had received only a residue of fallout from Tampa and Orlando, and none at all from Miami and Jacksonville. Even a reasonably clean weapon on Patrick would have rained radioactive particles on Fort Repose, but the enemy had not bothered to hit Patrick. Standing on the other side of the room, Preacher Henry had been listening, but he did not fully understand the designation of contaminated zones or comprehend the implications. He did feel and understand the shock and grief the broadcast brought to the Braggs, and he sensed it was time for him to leave. He nudged Malachi, touched Two-Tone's rump with his toe, caught the attention of Hannah and Missouri, and said with dignity, "We be going now. I thank you, Mr. Randy, for a real fine steak dinner. I hopes we can sometime repay it." Randy rose to his feet and said, "Good night, preacher. It was good to have you all." On the fourth day after the day, Randy, Malachi, and Two-Tone extended the artesian water system to the houses of Admiral Hazard and Florence Wetcheck. Stretching pipe across the grove to the Admiral's house was simple, but to provide water for Florence Wetcheck and Alice Cooksey, it was necessary to dig through the macadam of River Road with picks. On the night of the sixth day, the Riverside Inn burned. With no water in the hydrants and the hotel sprinkler system inoperative, the fire department was all but helpless. Only a few reserve firemen showed up, and only one pumper was got into action using river water. It was a puny effort and far too late. The old resinous wooden structure was burning brightly before the first stream touched the walls. Soon the heat drove the firemen away. A few minutes thereafter, the last scream was heard from the third floor. Dan had been summoned an hour later, and Randy had driven him into town. By then, there was nothing to do except care for the survivors. They were few. Some of these died of smoke poisoning or fear. It was hard to diagnose within a few hours. The burned were taken to San Marco in Bubba Offenhouse's hearse ambulances. The uninjured were lodged in the Fort Repose school. There was no heat in the school, or food, or water. It was simply shelter, less comfortable than the hotel, and within a few days, more squalid. Dan Gunn suspected that the fire had started in a room where the guests were using canned heat in an attempt to boil water, or perhaps someone had built a makeshift wood stove. It was, Dan said, inevitable. On the ninth day after the day, Lavinia McGovern died. This, too, had been inevitable ever since the lights went out and refrigeration ceased. Since Lavinia McGovern suffered from diabetes, insulin had kept her alive. Without refrigeration, insulin deteriorated rapidly. Not only Lavinia, but all diabetics in Fort Repose dependent upon insulin died at about the same period as the drug lost its potency. Randy and Dan had done their best to save her. They had driven to San Marco hoping to find refrigerated insulin or the new oral drug at the hospital. It was 18 miles to San Marco. Even driving at the most economical speed in his heavily horse-powered car, Randy estimated that the trip would consume 3 gallons of gasoline. He estimated he had only 5 gallons remaining in his tank, plus a 5-gallon can in reserve. Randy made a difficult decision. By then, the Bragg home was linked to the houses of Admiral Hazard, Florence Wetcheck, and the Henrys not only by an arterial system of pipes fed by nature's pressure, but by other common needs. The Henrys Model A was neither beautiful nor comfortable, but its engine was twice as thrifty as Randy's rakish sports hardtop. Sam Hazard's car gulped gasoline as fast as Randy's. Dan's was empty. The Model A was even more economical than Florence's old Chevy. Randy decided that henceforth the Model A would furnish community transportation. So it was in the Model A that Randy and Dan made the trip to San Marco. The trip was a failure. The hospital no longer possessed insulin or substitutes for insulin. Like the pharmacies, the hospital had purchased its supplies in small quantities and was dependent on weekly or biweekly deliveries from jobbers in the large cities. Its insulin had already gone to meet the demand in its own community. Further, the hospital's auxiliary generator was operated only during the evening hours for emergency operations and for a few minutes each hour on the hour to supply power for WSMF. It was necessary to conserve fuel, and unless the generator ran continuously, it was inadequate for refrigeration. Bouncing back to Fort Repose in the Model A, Dan grumbled, "The place we should have built up stockpiles was out in the country, like Timaquin County. Stockpiles weren't going to be of much use in the cities because after the day there weren't going to be any cities left. But where were the stockpiles? In the cities, of course. It was easier." So Lavinia McGovern, after 48 hours in coma, died. Alice Cooksey was at her bedside after midnight on the 9th day when Lavinia died. Lavinia's husband and daughter, both exhausted from the effort to keep the house in some sort of order, slept. Alice did not awaken them or anybody until morning. She kept vigil alone, dozing on a chaise. Nothing could help Lavinia, but everybody needed sleep. Alice brought the news to the Bragg house in the morning. A fire blazed in the dining room, which smelled pleasantly of bacon and coffee. Randy, Helen, the children, and Dan Gunn were at breakfast, a breakfast exactly like one they would have eaten 10 days before, with one important exception. There was orange juice, freshly squeezed, fresh eggs from the Henry's yard, bacon, coffee. There was no toast, because there was no bread. Randy already was beginning to miss bread, and he wondered why he had not thought to buy flour. By the time Helen had put flour on their list, the shelves were bare of it. He suspected that the older housewives of Fort Repose, remembering a time when people baked their own bread instead of buying it packaged, sliced with vitamins re-injected, had cleaned the stores out of flour on the day. He resolved, when he could, to trade for flour. It would be June before they could look forward to cornbread from Preacher Henry's crop. Alice had bicycled from the McGovern house. Before she closed the Western Union office, Florence Wetcheck had salvaged the messenger's bicycle. It was a valuable possession. Now that all their remaining gasoline was pooled to operate one car, the bicycle was primary transportation for Alice and Florence. Alice was for the first time in her life dressed in slacks, a necessity for bicycling. She accepted coffee and told of Lavinia's death. Bill McGovern and Elizabeth, she said, were taking it well, but they didn't know what to do with the body. They needed help with the burial.
"I'll go to see Bubba Offenhaus right away," Dan said, "and try to arrange for a burial. I've got to talk to Bubba anyway. I can't seem to impress upon him the importance of burying the dead as quickly as possible. He suddenly seems to hate his profession."
"That's not like Bubba," Alice Cooksey said. "Bubba always bragged that he was the most efficient undertaker in Florida. He used to say, when the retired started coming to Fort Repose, they found a mortuary with all modern conveniences."
"That's the trouble," Dan said. "Bubba abhors unorthodox funerals. He almost wept when I insisted that the poor devils who died in the fire be buried at once in a single grave. We had to use a bulldozer, you know. Bubba claims Repose in Peace Park is ruined for good. Randy had been silent since Alice brought the news. Now he spoke as if he had been holding silent debate with himself and had finally reached a conclusion. They'll have to live here.
Helen set down her coffee cup. Who'll have to live here?
We'll have to ask Lib and Bill McGovern to stay with us.
But we don't have room. And how will we feed them?
Randy was puzzled and disturbed. He had never thought of Helen as a selfish woman, and yet obviously she didn't want the McGoverns.
We really have plenty of room, he said. There's still an empty bedroom upstairs. Bill can have it, and Lib can sleep with you.
With me.
He could see that Helen was angry.
Well, you have twin beds in your room, Helen, but if you seriously object, Bill can sleep in my apartment. There's an extra couch, and Lib can have the room.
After all, it's your house, Helen said.
As a matter of fact, Helen, the house is half Mark's, which makes it half yours, so the decision is yours as well as mine. Lib and Bill have no water and no heat and not much food left because almost all their food reserve was in their freezer. They don't even have a fireplace. They've been cooking in boiling water on a charcoal grill in the Florida room.
Helen shrugged and said, Well, I guess you'll have to ask them. Elizabeth can sleep with me, but I hope it isn't a permanent arrangement. After all, our food supply is limited.
It is limited, Randy said, and it's going to get worse. Whether the McGoverns are here or not, we're all going to have to scrounge for food pretty quick.
Dan rose and said, I'd better get going.
Randy followed him. He had cultivated the habit of leaving his .45 automatic on the hall table and pocketing it as he left the house as a man would put on his hat. Since he never wore a hat and never before had carried a gun except in the army, he still had to make a conscious effort to remember. When they were in the car, Randy said, That was a strange way for Helen to behave. Don't know what's eating her.
Not at all strange, Dan said. Just human. She is jealous.
That's ridiculous.
No. Helen is a fiercely protective woman, protective of her children. With Mark gone, you and the house are her security and the children's security. She doesn't want to share you and your protection. Matter of self-preservation, not infatuation.
I see, Randy said. Or at least I think I see.
They drove up to the front of the McGovern house. Randy said, It's pointless for both of us to go in. Nothing you can do here. While you get Bubba Offenhaus, I'll tell them they're going to move and get them going.
Right, Dan said. Economy of effort enforces. Always a good rule of war.
Randy walked to the house, wondering a bit about himself. Without being conscious of it, he had begun to give orders in the past few days. Even to the Admiral he had given orders. He had assumed leadership in the tiny community bound together by the water pipes leading from the artesian well. Since no one had seemed to resent it, he guessed it had been the proper thing to do. It was like, well, it wasn't the same, but it was something like commanding a platoon. When you had the responsibility, you also had the right to command. The McGovern house was damp and it was chilly. It retained the cold of night. Lib, wearing corduroy jodhpurs and a heavy blue turtleneck sweater, greeted him at the door. She said, I heard the jalopy and I knew it was you. Thanks for coming, Randy. She held out her hands to him and he kissed her. Her hands felt cold, and when he looked down at them, he saw that her fingernails, always so carefully kept, were broken and crusted with dirt. Still, she was dry-eyed and calm. Whatever tears she had had for her mother were already shed. Randy said, Alice told us. We're all terribly sorry, darling. He knew it sounded insincere, and it was. With so many dead, so many friends for whom he had as yet not had time even for thought, the death of one woman whom he did not admire overmuch, and with whom he had never been and could not be close, was a triviality. With perhaps half the country's population dead, death itself, unless it took someone close and dear, was trivial. She said,
Come on in and talk to Dad. He's worried about how we're going to bury her. We're arranging that, Randy said, and followed her into the house. Bill McGovern sat in the living room, staring out on the river. He had not bothered to dress or shave. Over his pajamas and robe, he had pulled a top coat. Randy turned to Lib. Have either of you had any breakfast? She shook her head. No. Bill spoke without turning his head. Hello, Randy. I'm not much of a success, am I, in time of crisis? I can't feed my daughter or myself or even bury my wife. I wish I had enough guts to swim out into the channel and sink. That can't help Lavinia and wouldn't help Elizabeth or anybody. You and Lib are going to live with me. Things will be better. Randy, I'm not going to impose myself on you. I might as well face it. I'm finished. You know I'm over 60. And do you know what the worst thing is? Central tool and plate. I spent my whole life building it up. What is it now? Chances are, just a mess of twisted and burned metal. Junk. So there goes my life, and what good am I? I can't start over. Central tool and plate is junk, and I'm junk. Randy stepped over and stood between Bill and the cracked window so as to look into his face. You might as well stop feeling sorry for yourself, he said. You're going to have to start over. Either that or die. You have to face it. Lib touched her father's shoulder. Come on, Dad. Bill didn't move or reply. Randy felt anger inside him. You want to know what good you are? That means what good you are to somebody else, not to yourself, doesn't it? If you're no good to anybody else, I guess you'd better take the long swim. You know something about machinery, don't you? McGovern pushed himself in his chair. I know as much about machine tools as any man in America. I didn't say machine tools, I said machinery. Batteries, gasoline engines, simple stuff like that. I didn't start at Central Tool as president or board chairman. I started in the shop working with my hands. Sure, I know about machinery. That's fine. You can help Malachi and Admiral Hazard. We've taken the batteries out of my car and the Admiral's car and hooked them onto the Admiral's shortwave set so we can find out what cooks around the world. Only it doesn't work right. Something's wrong with the circuit and the batteries are fading and I don't know how we can charge them. Very simple, said Bill. Power take off from the Model A. It'll work so long as you have gas. Fine, Randy said. That's your first job, Bill, helping Malachi. Malachi? Isn't he the brother of a cleaning woman, Missouri, your yard man? That's him. First-class mechanic. Bill McGovern smiled. So I'll be mechanic second class? That's right. Bill rose. All right. It's a deal. I'll dress, and then he stopped. Oh, Lord, I forgot. Poor Lavinia. Randy, what am I going to do about her? He hesitated, as if the word were crude, but he could find no other. Body. We're attending to that, Randy said. Dan Gunn has gone up to get Bubba Offenhaus. I hope Bubba will handle the burial. Meanwhile, I think you and Lib better start packing. We'll have to make 3 or 4 trips, I guess. How much gas have you got in your car? Lib said, a couple of gallons, I think. That'll be enough to make the move, and you won't need the car after that. We can use the battery for Sam Hazard's shortwave set. While they packed, Randy prowled the house searching for useful items. In a kitchen cupboard, he discovered an old, pitted iron pot of tremendous capacity, and forgetting the presence of death in the house, whooped with delight. Lib raced into the kitchen, demanding a reason for the shouting. He hefted the pot. I'll bet it'll hold 2 gallons, he said. What a find. It's just an old pot Mother bought when we were in New England one summer. An antique. She thought it would look wonderful with a plant. It looked awful. It'll look beautiful hanging in the dining room fireplace, Randy said, filled with stew. The old pot was the most useful object. Indeed, it was one of the few useful objects he found in the McGovern house. 20 minutes later, Dan Gunn returned, alone and worried.
"Bubba Offenhaus," he said, "can't help us.
Bubba would like to bury himself. He's got dysentery, running at both ends. He and Kitty were certain it was radiation poisoning. Symptoms are pretty much alike, you know. Both of them were in panic. He'll get over it in a few days, but that's not helping us now."
Randy said, "So what do we do?"
Dan looked at Bill McGovern, fully dressed now, but still unwashed and unshaven, for there was no water in the house except a jug for drinking that Randy had brought to them the day before. Dan said, "I think that's up to you to decide, Bill."
"What is there to decide?" Bill asked.
"Whether to bury your wife here or in the cemetery. You don't have a plot and repose in peace, but I'm sure Bubba won't mind. Anyway, there's nothing he can do about it, and you can settle with him later."
Bill McGovern turned to his daughter.
"What do you say, Elizabeth?"
"Well, of course I think Mother deserves a proper funeral in a cemetery. It seems like the least we can do for her. And yet..."
She turned to Randy.
"You don't agree, do you, Randy?"
Randy was glad that she asked. Intervening in this private and personal matter was brutal but necessary.
"No, I don't agree. It's 6 miles to the cemetery. We'd have to make the trip in 2 cars because of Lavinia. That's 24 miles worth of gasoline round trip, and we can't afford it. We will have to bury Lavinia here, on the grounds."
"But how?" Lib began. "Where do you keep the shovels, Bill?"
"There's a tool shed back of the garage."
While handing a shovel to Dan and selecting one for himself, Randy examined the other tools. There was a new axe. It would be very useful. There were pitchforks, Edgar's, a scythe, a wheelbarrow. He would bring Malachi over before dark, and they would divvy up the McGovern tools. In everything he did now, he found he looked into the needs of the future. Between house and river, a crescent-shaped azalea bed flanked the west border of the McGovern property. The bitter blue grass had been carefully tended, and the bed was shaded from afternoon's hot sun by a live oak older than Fort Repose. Looking around, Randy could find no spot more suitable for a grave. He stepped off 6 feet and marked a rectangle within the crescent. He and Dan began to dig. After a few minutes, Randy removed his sweater. This was no easy job. Dan stopped and inspected his plans. He said, "I'm getting ditch diggers' hands. Very bad for a surgeon." They continued to dig steadily until it was awkward working from the surface. Randy stepped into the deepening grave. They had made a discovery. A grave designed to accommodate one person must be dug by one person alone. When Randy paused, winded, Bill McGovern stepped down and took the shovel, saying, "I'll spell you." From above, Lib watched. Presently, she said, "That's enough for you, Dad. Remember the blood pressure. I don't want to lose you, too." She stepped into the hole and relieved him of the shovel. After he climbed out, panting and white-faced, she thrust the shovel savagely into the sand. As she dug, her stature increased in Randy's eyes. She was like a fine sword, slender and flexible, but steel. A woman of courage. It was not gentlemanly, but Randy allowed her to dig, recognizing that physical effort was an outlet for her emotions. When her pace slowed, he dropped into the hole and took the shovel. "That's enough. Dan and I will finish. You and your father had better go back to the house and get on with your packing. You don't want us to help you carry her out, do you? I think it would be better if you didn't." Dan reached down and lifted her out of the hole. When the grave was finished, they wrapped Lavinia's emaciated body in her bedsheets. Her coffin was an electric blanket and her hearse a wheelbarrow. They lowered her into the 5-foot hole and packed in the sand and loam afterwards, leaving an insignificant mound. Randy knew that when spring came, the mound would flatten with the rains, the grass would swiftly cover it, and by June it would have disappeared entirely. Randy called the McGoverns. There was no service, no spoken word. They all stood silent for a moment, and then Bill McGovern said, "We don't even have a wooden marker for a sliver of stone, do we?"
"We could take something out of the house," Randy suggested. "A statue or a vase or something."
"It isn't necessary," Lib said. "The house is my mother's monument." This, of course, was true. They turned from the grave and back to their work. That evening, Bill McGovern, with some eagerness, walked to the Henry's house and talked to Malachi. Together they went along the riverbank to Sam Hazard's house and conferred with him on a plan for supplying power for the Admiral's shortwave receiver. Dan Gunn drove to Fort Repose to visit the homeless. Some of them sick or burned, lodged in the school. Randy and Lib McGovern sat alone on the front porch steps, Lib's elbows on her knees, her chin supported by her hands, Randy's arms encircling her shoulders. She was speaking of her mother. "I'm sure she never really comprehended what happened on the day, or ever could. Perhaps I'm only rationalizing, but I think her death was an act of mercy."
Randy heard someone running up the driveway, and then he saw the figure and recognized Ben Franklin.
"Ben," he called, "what's the matter?"
Ben stopped out of breath and said, "Something's happened at Miss Wetcheck's."
Randy rose, ready to get his pistol.
"What happened?"
"I don't know. I was just walking by her house, and I heard somebody scream. I think Miss Wetcheck. Then I heard her crying."
Randy said, "We better take a look, Lib. You stay here, Ben."
Yellow candlelight shone from Florence's kitchen. They went to the back door. Florence was wailing, and Randy entered without bothering to knock. As he opened the screen door, green and yellow feathers fluttered around his feet. Florence's head rested on her arms on the kitchen table. She was dressed in a quilted, rose-hued robe. Alice Cooksey was with her, coaxing water to a boil on a sterno kit. Randy said, "What seems to be the trouble?" Florence raised her head. Her untidy pink hair was moist and stringy. Her eyes were swollen.
"Sir Percy ate Anthony," she said.
She began to sob.
"She's had a terrible day," said Alice Cooksey. "I'm trying to make tea. She'll be better after she's had tea."
"What all happened?" Randy asked.
"It really began yesterday," Alice said. "When we woke up yesterday morning, the angelfish were dead. You know how cold it was night before last, and of course without electricity there's no heat for the aquarium. And this morning all the mollies and neons were dead. As a matter of fact, nothing's alive in the tank except the miniature catfish and a few guppies. And then, this evening..."
"Sir Percy,"
Florence interrupted,
"a murderer!"
"Hush, dear," Alice said. "The water will be boiling in a moment."
She turned to Randy.
"Florence really shouldn't blame Sir Percy. After all, there's been no milk for him, and very little of anything else. As a matter of fact, we haven't seen Sir Percy in 3 or 4 days. I suppose he was out hunting for himself. But a few minutes ago, when Anthony flew home, Sir Percy was on the porch."
"Ambushed poor Anthony,"
Florence said.
"Actually ambushed him. Killed him and ate him right there on the porch. Poor Cleo."
"Where's Sir Percy now?" Randy asked.
"He's gone again," Alice said. "He'd better not come back."
Randy was thoughtful. Hunting cats would be a problem. And what would happen to dogs? He still had a few cans of dog food for Graf, but he could foresee a time when humans might look upon dog food as a delicacy. He said aloud, but speaking to himself rather than the others, "Survival of the fittest."
"What do you mean?"
Lib said.
"The strong survive, the frail die. The exotic fish die because the aquarium isn't heated. The common guppy lives. So does the tough catfish. The house cat turns hunter and eats the pet bird. If he didn't, he'd starve. That's the way it is, and that's the way it's going to be."
Florence had stopped crying.
"You mean with humans? You mean we humans are going to have to turn savage like Sir Percy? Well, I can't do it. I don't want to live in that kind of a world, Randy."
"You'll live, Florence," Randy said. Walking back to his own house, Randy said, Florence is a guppy, a nice, drab little guppy. That's why she'll survive.
What about you and me? Lib said.
We're going to have to be tough. We're going to have to be catfish.
8. On a morning in April, 4 months after the day, Randy Bragg awoke and watched a shaft of sunlight creep down the wall. At the foot of the couch, Graff squirmed and then wormed his way upward under the blanket. During the January cold spell, Randy had discovered a new use for Graff. The Dachshund made a most satisfactory foot warmer, mobile, automatic, and operating on a minimum of fuel which he would consume anyway. Randy flung off the blanket and swung his feet to the floor. He was hungry. He was always hungry. No matter how much he ate the night before, he was always starving in the morning. He never had enough fats or sweets or starches, and the greater part of each day was usually spent in physical effort of one kind or another. Downstairs, Helen and Lib would be preparing breakfast. Before Randy ate, he would shower and shave. These were painful luxuries, almost his only remnant of routine from before the day. Randy walked to the bar counter and began to sharpen his razor. The razor was a 6-inch hunting knife. He honed its edges vigorously on a whetstone and then strapped it on a belt nailed to the wall. A clean, smooth, painless shave was one of the things he missed, but not what he missed most. He missed music. It had been a long time since he had heard music. The record player and his collection of LPs, of course, were useless without electricity. Music was no longer broadcast anywhere. Anyway, his second and last set of batteries for the transistor radio was losing strength. Very soon, they would have neither flashlights nor any means of receiving radio except through the Admiral's shortwave. WSMF in San Marco was no longer operating. Something had happened to the diesel supplying the hospital and the radio station, and it was impossible to find spare parts. This was the word that had come from San Marco, 18 miles away. It had required 2 days for the word to reach Fort Repose. He missed cigarettes, but not so much. Dan Gunn still had a few pounds of tobacco and had lent him a pipe. Randy found more pleasure in a pipe after each meal and one before bedtime than he had ever found in a whole carton of cigarettes. With tobacco so limited, each pipe was a luxury, relaxing and wonderful. He missed whiskey, not at all. Since the day, he had drunk hardly anything nor found need for it. He no longer regarded whiskey as a drink. Whiskey was Dan Gunn's emergency anesthetic. Whiskey, what was left of his supply, was for medical use and for trading. He missed his morning coffee most. It had been, he calculated, 6 or 7 weeks since he had tasted coffee. Coffee was more precious than gasoline or even whiskey. Tobacco could be grown and doubtless was being grown in a strip all the way from northwest Florida to Kentucky, Maryland, and Virginia in the rural areas still habitable. Whiskey you could make, given the proper equipment and ingredients. But coffee came from South America. Randy tested his knife on a bit of paper. It was as sharp as he could ever make it. He went into the bathroom and showered. The cold water no longer chilled him as it had through January and February. He was inured to it. Soap he used sparingly. The house reserve was down to 3 cakes. He dried and stepped on the scales. 152. This was exactly what he had weighed at 18 as a freshman at the university. Even after 3 months on the line in Korea, he had dropped only to 156. He had lost an average of a pound a week for the past 16 weeks. But now, he noted, his weight loss was slower. He had held 152 for the past 3 days. He was leaner and harder and, truthfully, felt better than before the day. There was a knock on the living room door. That would be Peyton. He slipped on his shorts and said, "Come in." Peyton came in, carefully balancing the tiny pot of steaming water allotted for his morning shave. She set the pot before him on the counter as if it were a crystal bowl filled with flowers. "There," she said. "Can I watch you shave this morning, Randy?" The sight of Peyton enriched Randy's mornings. She was brash and buoyant, bobbing like a brightly colored cork in the maelstrom, unsinkable and unafraid. "Why do you like to watch me shave?" he asked. "Because you make such funny faces in the mirror. You should see yourself."
"I do."
"No, you don't really see yourself. All you watch is the knife, as if you're afraid of cutting your throat."
Dan Gunn came out of the bedroom, dressed in Levi's and a blue-checked sports shirt. Until the day, Dan had used an electric razor. Now, rather than learn to shave with a knife or whatever was available, he did not shave at all. His beard had bloomed thick and flaming red. He looked like a Klondike sourdough or a Paul Bunyan transplanted to the semi-tropics. On those rare days when his beard was freshly trimmed and he dressed formally in white shirt and a tie, he looked like a physician outsized 1890 model. "You can't watch today," Randy told the child. "I want to talk to Dr. Gunn." He poured his hot water into the basin and returned the pot to Peyton. Peyton smiled at Dan and left. Randy soaped and soaked his face. "Did you know that Einstein never used shaving soap?" he said. "Einstein just used plain soap like this. Einstein was a smart man, and what was good enough for Einstein is good enough for me." He scraped at his beard, winced, and said, "Einstein must have had an awfully good razor. Einstein must have used a fresh blade every morning. I'll bet Einstein never shaved with a hunting knife." Dan said, "I had an awful dream last night. Dreamed I'd forgotten to pay my income tax and was behind in my alimony, and the treasury agents and a couple of deputy sheriffs were chasing me around the courthouse with shotguns. They finally cornered me. They were arguing about whether to send me to the federal pen or state prison. I tried to sneak out. I think they shot me. Anyway, I woke up shaking. All I could think of was that I really hadn't paid my income tax or alimony either. What day is it, anyway?"
"I don't know what day it is, but I know the date. April 14th.
Dan smiled through the red beard. "My subconscious must be a watchdog. Income tax day tomorrow. And we don't have to file a return, Randy. No tax. No alimony. Let us count our blessings. Never thought I'd see the day."
"No coffee," Randy said. "I would gladly pay my tax tomorrow for a pound of coffee.
Dan, if you drive to town today, I want to go with you. I want to trade for coffee." Dan had evolved a barter system for his services. He charged a gallon of gas, if the patient had it, for house calls. Most families had somehow managed to obtain and conserve a few gallons of gasoline. It was their length with a mobile past, insurance of mobility in some emergency of the future. Sickness and injury were emergencies for which they would gladly dip into their liquid reserve. Dan made little profit. Perhaps half his patients were able and willing to pay with gasoline. Still, he managed to keep the Model A's tank nearly full, and on his rounds he was continuously charging batteries. Bill McGovern had instituted a system of rotating the batteries in the car. In turn, the charged batteries powered Admiral Hazard's shortwave receiver. Not only was the car transport for Randy's water-linked enclave of families, it was necessary to maintain their ear to the world outside. Not that the world any longer said much. Dan said, "Sure, Randy, but it's going to take all morning. I've got a bad situation in town."
"What's the trouble?"
From downstairs they heard Helen's voice.
"Breakfast.
Tell you later," Dan said. Randy was last to reach the dining room. There was a tall glass of orange juice at his place and a big pitcher of juice in the center of the table. Whatever else they might lack, there was always citrus. Yet even orange juice would eventually disappear. In late June or early July, they would squeeze the last of the Valencias and use the last grapefruit. From then until the new crop of early oranges ripened in October, citrus would be absent from their diet. He saw that this morning there was a single boiled egg and small portion of broiled fish left over from the night before. "Where's my other boiled egg?" he said.
"Malachi only brought over 8 eggs this morning," Helen said. "The Henrys have been losing chickens."
"What do you mean, losing them?"
"They're being stolen."
Randy put down his juice.
Citrus, fish, and eggs were their staples. A drop in the egg supply was serious.
I'll bet it's an inside job, he said. I'll bet that no-good two-tone has been swapping hens for liquor.
Lib spoke. Malachi thinks it's wild cats. That is, house cats that have gone wild.
That's not the worst of it, Helen said. One of the Henry's pigs is missing. They heard it squeal just once. Preacher thinks a wolf took it. Preacher says he found a wolf track.
No wolves in Florida, Randy said. No four-legged wolves. The loss of hens was serious, but the loss of pigs disastrous. The Henry sow had produced a farrow that in a few weeks would add real meat to everybody's diet. Even now, they weighed 12 to 15 pounds. Each evening, all food scraps from the Bragg, Wetcheck, and Hazard households were carried to the Henry place to help feed the pigs and chickens. Every day, Randy had to argue with Helen and Lib to save scraps for Graff. Randy was conscious that the Henrys supplied more than their own share of food for the benefit of all. When Preacher's corn crop ripened in June, the disparity would be even greater. And it had been Two-Tone, of all people, who had suggested that they grow sugarcane and then had explored the riverbanks in the Henry's leaky, flat-bottomed skiff until he had found wild cane. He had sprigged, planted, and cultivated it. Because of the Henrys, they could all look forward one day to a breakfast of cornbread, cane syrup, and bacon. He was sure they would find a way to convert the corn to meal, even if they had to grind it between flagstones.
I don't think we're doing enough for the Henrys, Randy said. We'll have to give them more help.
What kind of help? Bill McGovern asked.
At the moment, help them guard the food supply, keep away the prowlers, cats, wolves, humans, or whatever.
Can't the Henrys do it themselves? Helen asked. Don't they have a gun?
They've got a gun, an old beat-up single-barrel 12-gauge, but they don't have time. You can't expect Preacher and Malachi to work as hard as they do every day and then sit up all night. And I wouldn't trust Two-Tone. He'd just sleep. Do I hear volunteers?
Me, said Ben Franklin.
Randy's first impulse was to say no, that this wasn't a job for a 13-year-old boy. Yet Ben was eating as much as a man, or more, and he would have to do a man's work.
I thought you and Caleb were chopping firewood today.
I can chop wood and stand watch, too.
Better let me take it the first night, said Bill McGovern. I wouldn't want to see anything happen to those pigs.
Bill was thinner, as they all were, and yet it seemed that he had dropped years as well as weight. With his fork, he touched a bit of fish at the edge of his plate.
You know, for years, I looked forward to my vacation in the Basque Country. That's why I built a house on the Timucuan when I retired. But now, I can hardly look a bass in the face. I want meat. Real red meat.
Randy had his decision.
All right, Bill. You can take the watch tonight and we'll rotate thereafter. I'm sure the Admiral will take a night, too.
Do I get a night? Ben Franklin asked. His eyes were pleading.
You get a night, Ben. I'll make up a schedule and post it on the bulletin board.
A bulletin board in the hallway with assignment of duties had become a necessity. In this new life, there was no leisure. If everybody worked as hard as he could until sundown every day, then everybody could eat, although not well. Each day brought a crisis of one kind or another. They faced shortages of the most trivial but necessary items. Who would have had the foresight to buy a supply of needles and thread?
Florence Wetcheck owned a beautiful new sewing machine, electric and useless, of course.
Florence, Helen, and Hannah Henry did the sewing for Randy's community. Yesterday, Florence had broken a needle and had come to Randy close to tears, as if it were a major disaster, as indeed it was. And everybody had unthinkingly squandered matches so that now there were no matches. He still had 5 lighter flints and 1 small can of lighter fluid. Luckily, his old army lighter would burn gasoline, but flints were priceless and impossible to find. Within a few months, it might be necessary to keep the dining room fire going day and night in spite of unwelcome heat and added labor. Nor would their supply of wood last forever. They would have to scout farther and farther afield for usable timber. Hauling it would become a major problem. When Dan could no longer collect his gasoline fees and the tank in the Model A finally ran dry, their life was bound to change drastically, and for the worse. staring down at his plate, he thought of all this.
Lib said, "Randy, finish your fish, and you'd better drink another glass of orange juice. You'll be hungry before lunch if Helen and I can put a lunch together."
"I hate orange juice," Randy said, and poured himself another glass.
Dan drove, Randy beside him. It was warm, and Randy was comfortable in shorts, boat shoes, and a pullover shirt. He carried his pistol holstered at his hip. The pistol had become a weightless part of him now. He had dry-fired it 1,000 times until it felt good in his hand, and even used it to kill a rattlesnake in the grove and 2 moccasins on the dock. Shooting snakes was a waste of ammunition, but he was now confident of the pistol's accuracy and the steadiness of his hand. In Randy's lap, encased in a paper bag, was the bottle of scotch he hoped to trade for coffee. They smoked their morning pipes. Randy said, "Dan, what's this bad situation in town?"
"I haven't said anything about it," Dan said, "because I can't get to the bottom of it, and I didn't want to frighten anybody. I've got 3 serious cases of radiation poisoning."
"Oh, God," Randy said, not an exclamation, but a prayer. This was the sword that had been hanging over all of them. If a man kept busy enough, if his troubles and problems were immediate and numerous, if he was always hungry, then he could for a time wall off this thing, forget for a time that he lived in what had officially been designated a contaminated zone. He could forget the insidious, the invisible, the implacable enemy, but not forever.
"This is very strange," Dan said. "I can't believe it's caused by delayed fallout. If it were, I'd have 300 cases, not 3. This is more like a radium or X-ray burn. All of them have burned hands in addition to the usual symptoms. Nausea, headache, diarrhea, hair falling out."
"When did it start?" Randy asked.
"Porky Logan was the first man hit. His sister caught me at the school 3 weeks ago and begged me to look at him."
"Wasn't Porky somewhere in the southern part of the state on the day? Couldn't he have picked up radiation then?"
"Porky was perfectly all right when he got back here, and since then he hasn't received any more exposure than the rest of us. And the other 2 have not left Fort Repose. Porky's a mess. Every time I see him, he's drunk, but the radiation is killing him faster than the liquor."
"Who else is sick?"
"Big Mouth Bill Cullen. We'll stop at his fish camp on the way to town. And Pete Hernandez."
"Couldn't be sort of an epidemic, could it?" Randy asked.
"No, it couldn't. Radiation's not a germ or a virus. You can eat or drink radioactive matter, like strontium-90 in milk. It can fall on you in rain. It can sift down on you in dust or in particles you can't see on a day that seems perfectly clear. You can track it into the house on your shoes, or pick it up by handling any metal or inorganic matter that has been exposed, but you can't catch it by kissing a girl, unless, of course, she has gold teeth."
At the bend of River Road, they caught up with Alice Cooksey riding Florence's Western Union bicycle. Alone of all the people in Fort Repose, Alice continued with her regular work. Every morning she left the Wetchek house at 7. Often, ignoring the unpredictable dangers of the road, she did not return until dark. Since the day, the demand for her services had multiplied. They slowed when they overtook her, shouted a greeting, and waved. She waved back and pedaled on, a small, brave, and busy figure. Watching the car chuff past, Alice reminded herself that this evening she must bring back new books for Ben Franklin and Peyton. It was a surprise and a delight to see children devour books. Without ever knowing it, they were receiving an education. Alice would never admit it aloud, but for the first time in her 30 years as librarian of Fort Repose, she felt fulfilled, even important. It had not been easy or remunerative to persist as librarian in Fort Repose. She recalled how every year for 8 years the town council had turned down her annual request for air conditioning. An expensive frill, they'd said. But without air conditioning, how could a library compete? Drug stores, bars, restaurants, movies, the St. John's Country Club in San Marco, the lobby of the Riverside Inn, theaters, and most homes were air-conditioned. You couldn't expect people to sit in a hot library during the humid Florida summer, which began in April and didn't end until October, when they could be sitting in an air-conditioned living room coolly and painlessly absorbing visual pablum on television. Alice had installed a Coke machine and begged old electric fans, but it had been a losing battle. In 30 years, her book budget had been raised 10%, but the cost of books had doubled. Her magazine budget was unchanged, but the cost of magazines had tripled. So while Fort Repose grew in population, book borrowings dwindled. There had been so many new distractions, drive-in theaters, dashing off to springs and beaches over the weekends, the mass hypnosis of the young every evening, and finally the craze for boating and water skiing. Now, all this was ended. All entertainment, all amusements, all escape, all information again centered in the library. The fact that the library had no air conditioning made no difference now. There were not enough chairs to accommodate her readers. They sat on the front steps, in the windows, on the floor with backs against walls or stacks. They read everything, even the classics. And the children came to her when they were free of their chores and she guided them. And there was useful research to do. Randy and Dr. Gunn didn't know it, but as a result of her research, they might eat better thereafter. It was strange, she thought, pedaling steadily, that it should require a Holocaust to make her own life worth living. At the town limits, Dan turned into Bill Cullen's Fish Camp Cafe and Bar. The grounds were more dilapidated and filthier than ever. The liquor shelves were bare. The counters in the boathouse tackle shop were empty. Not a plug, fly, or hook remained. Big Mouth Bill had been cleaned out months before. His wife, straw-haired and barrel-shaped, stepped out of the living quarters. Randy sniffed. She didn't smell of spiked wine this day. She simply smelled sour. Alone, of all the people he had seen, she had gained weight since the day. Randy guessed that she had cashed sacks of grits and had been living on grits and fried fish. She said, "He's in here, Doc." Dan didn't go in immediately. "Does he seem any better?" he asked. "He's worse. His hands is leaking pus." "How do you feel? You haven't had any of his symptoms, have you?"
"Me? I don't feel no different. I felt worse,"
she giggled, showing her rotting teeth.
"You ever had a hangover, Doc? That's when I felt worse. Right now, I wish I felt worse so I could take a drink and feel better. You get it, Doc?"
She came closer to Dan and lowered her voice.
"He ain't going to die, is he?"
"I don't know."
"The old tightwad better not die on me now. He's not leaving me nothing, Doc. He don't even own this place free and clear. He ain't never even made no will.
He's holding out on me, Doc. I can tell. He had 6 cases stashed away after the day. Claims he sold all 6 to Porky Logan. But he don't show me no money. You know what, Doc? I think he's got that 6 cases hid."
Dan brushed past her and they entered the shack. Bill Cullen lay on a sagging iron bed, a stained sheet pulled up to his bare waist. In the bad light filtering through the Venetian shade over the single window, he was at first unrecognizable to Randy. He was wasted, his eyes sunken, his eyeballs yellow. Tufts of hair were gone from one side of his head, exposing reddish scalp. His hands resting across his stomach were swollen, blackened, and cracked. He croaked,
"Hello, Doc."
He saw Randy and said,
"I'll be damned, Randy."
The stench was too much for Randy. He gagged, said, "Hello, Bill," and backed out. He leaned over the dock railing, coughing and choking until he could breathe deeply of the sweet wind from the river. When Dan came out, they walked silently back to the car together. All Dan said was, "She was right. He's worse. I'll swear he's had a fresh dose of radiation since I saw him last." They drove on to Marines Park. The park had become the barter center of Fort Repose. Dan said, "Do you want to go on with me to the schoolhouse?" "No thanks," Randy said. He was glad he wasn't a doctor. A doctor required special courage that Randy felt he did not possess. "I'll pick you up here in an hour. Then I'll see Hernandez and Logan and then home." "Okay." Randy got out of the car. "Don't swap for less than 2 pounds. Scotch is darn near as scarce as coffee." "I'll make the best deal I can," Randy promised. Dan drove off. Randy tucked the bottle under his arm and walked toward the bandstand, an octagon-shaped wooden structure. Its platform elevated 3 feet above what had once been turf smooth as a gold green, now unkempt, infiltrated with weeds and booby-trapped with sand spurs. A dozen men, legs dangling, sat on the platform and steps. Others moved about, the alert, humorless smile of the trader on their faces. 3 bony horses were tethered to the bandstand railing. Like Randy, some of the men carried holsters at their belts. A few shotguns and an old-fashioned Winchester leaned against the planking. The armed men had come in from the countryside, a risk. A third of the traders in Marines Park on this day were Negroes. The economics of disaster placed a penalty upon prejudice. The laws of hunger and survival could not be evaded and honored no color line. A backyard hen raised by a Negro tasted just as good as the gamecocks of Carlton Howes, the well-to-do realtor who was a vice president of the county White Citizens Council, and there was more meat on it. Randy saw Hawes, a brace of chickens dangling from his belt, drink water, presumably boiled from a Negro's jug. There were 2 drinking fountains in Marines Park, one marked white only, the other colored only. Since neither worked, the signs were meaningless. Hawes saw Randy, wiped his mouth, and called, "Hey, Randy."
"Hello, Carlton."
"What are you trading?"
"A bottle of scotch."
Hawes' eyes fixed on the paper bag and he moved closer to Randy, cautious as a pointer blundered upon quail. Randy recalled from Saturday nights at the St. John's Club that scotch was Hawes' drink.
"What's your asking price?"
Hawes asked. 2 pounds of coffee."
"I'll swap you these 2 birds. Both young hens. See how plump they are? Better eating you'll never have."
Randy laughed.
"Being it's you, I'll tell you what I'll do. I've got eggs at home. I'll throw in a couple of dozen eggs, have 'em here tomorrow. On my word, if you don't believe me, you can take the birds now as a binder."
"The asking price," Randy said, "is also the selling price. 2 pounds of coffee. Any brand will do." Hawes sighed.
"Who's got coffee? It's been 3 months since I've had a drink of scotch. Let me look at the bottle, will you?"
Randy showed him the label and moved on to the bandstand. The square pillars supporting the roof had become a substitute for the county weekly's want-ad section and the radio station announcements. Randy read the notices, some in longhand, some hand-printed, a few typewritten, pinned to the timbers. "Will swap. Late model Cadillac Coupe de Ville. Radio, heater, air-conditioned, battery run down but undamaged, for 2 good 28-inch bicycle tires and pump. Desperately need evaporated milk, rubber nipple, and 6 safety pins. Look over our house and make your own deal. Have small canned ham. Want large kettle, Encyclopedia Britannica, box 12-gauge number 7 shells, and toothpaste." Randy closed his eyes. He could taste that ham. He had an extra kettle, the encyclopedia, the shells, and toothpaste. But he also had prospects of fresh ham if they could preserve the Henry's young pigs from marauders, wolves, or whatever.
Anyway, it was too big a price to pay for a small ham.
Wanted. 3 2-0 fish hooks in exchange for expensive fly rod, reel, assorted lures.
Randy chuckled. Sports fishing no longer existed. There were only meat fishermen now.
We'll trade 50 horsepower outboard motor, complete set power tools, cashmere raglan top coat for half pound of tobacco and axe.
Randy saw a notice that was different.
Easter services. An interdenominational Easter sunrise service will be held in Marines Park on Sunday, April 17th. All citizens of Fort Repose of whatever faith are invited to attend. Signed, Reverend John Carlin, First Methodist Church, Reverend M. F. Kinney, Church of St. Paul's, Reverend Fred Bourne, Timaquin Baptist Church, Reverend Noble Watts, Afro Repose Baptist Church.
The name of the rector of St. Thomas Episcopal Church, where there had always been a Bragg pew, was missing. Dr. Lucius Somerville, a gentle white-haired man, a boyhood companion of Judge Bragg, had been in Jacksonville on the morning of the day, and therefore would not return to his parish. Randy wasn't much of a churchgoer. He had contributed to the church regularly, but not of his time or himself. Now, reading this notice, he felt an unexpected thrill. Since the day he had lived in the imperative present, not daring to plan beyond the next meal or the next day. This bit of paper tacked on peeling white paint abruptly enlarged his perspective, as if stumbling through a black tunnel he saw or thought he saw a chink of light. If man retained faith in God, he might also retain faith in man. He remembered words which for 4 months he had not heard, read, or uttered, the most beautiful words in the language, faith and hope. He had missed these words as he had missed other things. If possible, he would go to the service. Sunday the 17th. Today was the 14th, and therefore Thursday. He stepped up on the platform. The men lounging there, some of them acquaintances, some strangers, were estimating the shape of bulk of the sack he held like a football under his arm. Dour, bearded, hair unshorn or ludicrously cropped, they looked like ghost town characters in a Western movie, except they were not so well fed as Hollywood extras, and their clothing, flowered sports shirts, shorts or slacks, plaid or straw-peaked caps, was incongruous. John Garcia, the Menorcan fishing guide, asked the orthodox opening question, "What are you trading, Randy?" "A fifth of scotch, 12 years old, the best." Garcia whistled. "You must be hard up. What are you asking?"
2 pounds of coffee."
Several of the men on the platform shifted their position. One snickered. None spoke. Randy realized that these men had no coffee, either for trading or drinking. No matter how well stocked their kitchens might once have been, or what they had purchased or pillaged on the day and in the chaotic period immediately after, 4 months had exhausted everything. Randy's community was far more fortunate, with the bearing groves, fish loyally taking bait, the industrious Henrys in their barnyard, and some small game, squirrels, rabbits, and an occasional possum. John Garcia was trading 2 strings of fish, a 4-pound catfish and a small bass on one, warm-mouth perch and bream on the other. Garcia's brown and weathered skin had shriveled on his slight frame until he seemed only bones loosely wrapped in dried leather. The sun was getting warm. With his toe, Garcia nudged his fish into the shadow. "Wouldn't trade for fish, would you, Randy?" he asked, smiling.
"Fish we've got," Randy said.
"You River Road people do all right by yourselves, don't you?"
a stranger said.
"If you got scotch liquor, you got everything. Us, we ain't got nothing."
The stranger was trading a saw, 2 chisels, and a bag of nails. Randy guessed he was an itinerant carpenter settled in Pistolville. Randy ignored him and asked Marines Park's inevitable second question. "What do you hear?"
Old man Hochstatler, who was trading small tins of aspirins and tranquilizers salvaged from his looted farms, he said,
I hear the Russians are asking that we surrender.
No, no, you got that all wrong, said Eli Blaustein. Mrs. Van Brucker Brown demanded that the Russians surrender. They said no, and then they said we should be the ones to surrender.
Where did you hear that? Randy asked.
My wife got it from a woman whose husband's battery set still works, Blaustein said. Blaustein was trading work pants and a pair of white Oxfords, and he was asking canned corned beef or cheese. Randy knew that as the sun got higher, John Garcia's asking price for his fish would drop lower. At the same time, Blaustein's hunger would grow, or he would be thinking of his protein-starved family. Before the fish were tainted, there would be a meeting of minds. John Garcia would have a new pair of work pants, and Blaustein would have food.
What I would like to know, said old man Hochstatler, is who won the war. Nobody ever tells you. This war I don't understand at all. It isn't like World Wars I or II or any other wars I've heard of. Sometimes I think the Russians must have won. Otherwise things would be getting back to normal. And then I think, no, we won. If we hadn't won, the Russians would still be bombing us, or they would invade. But since the day, I've never seen any planes at all.
I have, said Garcia. I've seen them while I was fishing for cats at night.
No, that ain't exactly right. I've heard them. I heard one 2 nights ago.
Whose? Blaustein asked. Garcia shrugged.
Beats me.
This discussion, Randy knew, would continue through the day. The question of who won the war, or if the war still continued, who was winning, had replaced the weather as an inexhaustible subject for speculation. Each day you could hear new rumors, usually baseless and always garbled. You could hear that Russian landing craft were lined up on Daytona Beach, or that Martian saucers were unloading relief supplies in Pensacola. Randy believed nothing except what he himself heard or saw, or those sparse hard grains of fact sifted from the airwaves by Sam Hazard. Randy had been leaning on the bandstand railing. He straightened, stretched, and said, "Guess I'll circulate around and look for somebody who's holding coffee." John Garcia said,
"You coming to the Easter service, Randy?"
"Hope so. Hope to come and bring the family." As he stepped from the bandstand, he looked again at the two useless drinking fountains. There was something important about them that he could not recall. This was irritating, as when the name of an old friend capriciously vanishes from memory. The drinking fountains made his mind itch. He saw Jim Hickey, the beekeeper, a picnic basket under his long outstretched legs, relaxed on a bench. Before the day, Jim had rented his hives to grove owners pollinating young trees. Before the day, Jim's honey was a secondary source of income. Gravy, he called it. Now honey was liquid gold, and beeswax, with which candles could be dipped, another valuable item of barter. Jim Hickey, who was Mark's age, had learned beekeeping at the College of Agriculture in Gainesville. It would never make him rich, he had been warned, and until the day it hadn't. Now he was regarded as a fortunate man, rich in highly desirable commodities endlessly produced by tens of thousands of happy and willing slaves.
What are you trading?
He greeted Randy.
A bottle of scotch.
Are you holding coffee?
No, I've been trying to trade for coffee myself. Can't find any. All I hold is honey.
He lifted the lid of the picnic basket.
Lovely stuff, isn't it?
It was lovely. Randy thought of Ben Franklin and Peyton, whose need and desire for sweets could not be wholly supplied by the sugar content of citrus. It would be weeks before Two-Tone's cane crop matured. Randy wondered whether he was being selfish trading for coffee. It was true that he would share the coffee with the other adults on River Road, but the children didn't drink it. There were no calories or vitamins in coffee, and it was of no use to them. He forced himself to be judicial. When you examine the facts judicially
and asked which would provide the greatest good for the greatest number, there could be only one answer. Coffee would furnish only temporary and personal gratification. He said, "Jim, maybe I could be persuaded to trade for honey."
"I'm sorry, Randy. We're Adventists. We don't drink whiskey or trade in it."
This contingency Randy had never imagined. Half aloud, he said, "Well, I tried."
"I suppose you want the honey for Mark's children," Hickey said.
"Yes, I did." Hickey reached into the basket and brought out two square, honey-packed combs.
"I wouldn't like to see Mark's kids go without," he said. "Here, I give you more, except my supply is way down. There's something wrong with my bees this spring. Half my broods are foul, full of dead pupae and larvae. At first, I thought it was what we call sac brood or queen failure. I've been to the library reading up on it, and now I wonder whether it couldn't be radiation. We must have had fallout on the day. After all, the whole state is a contaminated zone, and maybe it affected some of my queens and drones. I don't know what to do about it. It isn't something they taught us at the university."
Randy removed the bottle from his paper bag, locked it under his arm, and replaced it with the honeycombs. He was overwhelmed. He knew that Mark and Hickey had been in the same grade in primary school, but they had never been close friends. Hickey was no more than an acquaintance. He lived in a neat, sea-green, five-room concrete block house far out on the road to Pasco Creek. Randy, before the day, rarely saw him, and then only to wave a greeting. Randy said, "Jim, this is the nicest, most generous thing I can remember. I just hope I can repay you some way, some day."
"Forget it," Hickey said. "Children need honey. My kids have it every meal."
Randy heard the Model A's horn, raucous as an angry goose, and saw it pull up to the curb. Walking to the car, he noticed that it was a clear and beautiful spring day, a better day than yesterday. The spores of kindness, as well as faith, survived in this acid soil. Randy climbed into the car and showed the honey to Dan and explained how it had been given to him.
"The world changes," Dan said. "People don't. I still have one old biddy in the schoolhouse who prunes and trims the camellias and weeds the beds. They aren't her camellias, and nobody gives a damn about flowers anymore, except her. She loves flowers, and it doesn't matter where she is or what happens, she's going to take care of them. The same old lady, Mrs. Satterborough, she's been spending her winters at the Riverside Inn for years. She picks up the telephone in the principal's office every morning and dials Western Union. She thinks that one day the phone will be working just fine and that she'll get off a telegram to her daughter. She's certain of it. Her daughter lives in Indiana."
"I don't understand how those old people stay alive," Randy said. He knew that Dan brought them oranges by the bushel, and Randy sent them fish whenever there was a surplus catch.
"Most of them didn't. Death can be merciful, especially for the old and sick. I was about to say old, sick, and broke, but it doesn't matter any longer whether you're broke. Only five alive out of the Riverside Inn now. Maybe three will get through the summer. I don't think any will get through next winter."
Driving north on Yulee, the business district, while deserted, seemed no more battered than it had the month before or the month before that. A few optimistic storekeepers had prudently boarded windows split by blast on the day or broken by looters afterwards, against water and wind. On the two principal business blocks, glass had been swept from the sidewalks. Abandoned cars stripped of wheels, batteries, radios, and spark plugs rusted in gutters like the unburied carcasses of giant beetles. They turned off Yulee into Augustine Road with its broken macadam and respectable but decaying residences. They bounced along for a block and then Randy smelled Pistolville. Another block and they were in it. There had been no garbage collection since the day. In Pistolville, each hut or house squatted in a mound of its own excretion. Crushed crates and cartons, rusting tin cans, broken bottles, rotting piles of citrus rusks and pecan shells,
the bones of fowl, fish, and small animals. A tallow-faced, 6-year-old girl, clad in a man's cast-off riddled t-shirt, crouched on the curb, emptying her bowels in the dust. She cried out shrilly and waved as the Model A bounced past. A bearded, long-haired man burst out of a doorway and jogged down the street on bandy legs, peeling and eating a banana, turning his head as if he expected to be followed. At the corner, a scrawny boy of 18 urinated against a lamppost, not bothering to raise his eyes at the sound of the car. Buzzards, grown arrogant, roosted in the oaks and foraged in the refuse. Of mongrel dogs, cats, parti-hued pigs, chickens, and pigeons, all normal impediments to navigation on the streets of Pistolville, no trace remained. Once before in his life, in Suan, immediately after its recapture and before the military government people had begun to clean up, Randy had seen degradation such as this. But this was America. It was his town, settled by his forebears. He said, "We've got to do something about this." "Yes," Dan said. "What?" "I don't know. Something." "Torches and gasoline," Dan said, "except there isn't enough gasoline. Anyway, these poor devils are as well off in their own houses as they would be in the woods or in caves. No better off, mind you, but they have shelter." "In 4 months," Randy said, "we've regressed 4,000 years. More, maybe. 4,000 years ago, the Egyptians and Chinese were more civilized than Pistolville is right now. Not only Pistolville. Think what must be going on in those parts of the country where they don't even have fruit and pecans and catfish." As they approached the end of Augustine Road, the houses were newer and larger, constructed of concrete block or brick instead of pitch-sweating pine clapboard. Between these houses, grass grew shin-high, fighting the exultant weeds for sunlight and root space. There was less filth, or at least it was concealed by greenery, and the smell was bearable. In this airier atmosphere lived the upper crust of Pistolville, including Pete and Rita Hernandez, and Timequin County's representative in the state legislature, Porky Logan. "How long has it been since you've seen Rita?" Dan asked. "Not since